All right, in just a moment, Brother Rick Green is going to come. Jonathan, we need to make sure that we have a mic set up for, we're going to do a Q&A just like we did when Frank Turk was here as well. And so that's why we're getting started right away to give Rick the maximum amount of time. So let me introduce Rick Green. Rick is an attorney, an author, and a speaker. And I think it's fair to say a director as well, right? I think you're pretty involved in at least reviewing and making video productions. Rick earned his four-year degree in 2 years. Parents, wouldn't you love that? I mean, that is remarkable. Taking twice the average course load. I can't even say it. How in the world would I do such a thing? Entered law school at 20 years old, the youngest man to enter the University of Texas Law School. Well, in his first year of law school, Rick sold everything he owned and started a talent agency and a video production company with TV sales of over $500,000 many years ago. He also earned his doctorate degree, or doctorate of jurisprudence, from that same university. Practiced corporate law with an emphasis on helping entrepreneurs start their own businesses. Rick was elected to the Texas legislature at the age of 27. And Rick, we do have several from the state of Texas here as well. 1999 to 2003, currently consults and advises state officials. In the summer of 2000, Rick founded the Torch of Freedom Foundation, which, as I understand it, is an organization dedicated to helping the nation's future leaders develop a proper perspective of our heritage and really prepare them to impact politics. In November 2001, Rick joined forces with noted historian and author David Barton and has been working with wall builders since then. Rick is married to Kara Renee, and they have 3 sons and 1 daughter. So come, Brother Rick Green, and present. Amen.
Thank you, man. Builders or David Barton? Let me see a show of hands out there. Fantastic. Very proud to represent David and Wall Builders. I'm always hesitant to say proud in church, though. You know, you got to watch that pride. It'll sneak up on you, man. I was only 27 when I got elected to the legislature. My head started swelling. My wife said it got so big I couldn't get through the door. She thought a little humbling needed to take place. She started praying for that. How many of you know when you need to be humbled, God will step in and take care of that? Amen? All right. In my case, it took about 2 weeks. I was setting up my district office there in the big city I live in, Dripping Springs, Texas, which I'm sure everybody here has been to Dripping Springs, right? Nobody. Okay. Anyway, so I'm setting things up and I'm thinking, man, I don't want everybody around here to know how young I am, how naive I am, that I have no idea what I'm doing. So I thought I'd try to create kind of an air of longevity, like I'd been around a while and had some experience. I went to my doctor friends in the neighborhood, got the old magazines out of their lobby, put them in my lobby. Then I'm in the back and I'm setting things up. You know, I'm putting the desks together and all that. And I hear this guy come in. And so I've got to be busy, you know, new state rep in town. I got to be important. So before he could get back to my office, I grabbed my phone and said, no, I can't. Can't see you Thursday. I'm booked. No, I'm booked next Thursday as well. But 2 weeks from Thursday, 10 o'clock, I'll meet you right here in my office. This guy's come all the way through. He's standing there waiting for me to get off the phone. I put the phone down. I said, yes, sir. Can I help you? He said, no, I'm just here to hook up that there phone for you, son. That will humble you a little bit, all right? Let me just tell you right now. I'm hoping that took care of the personal pride. Now, the Texas pride, I'm not apologizing for. You're just going to have to live with it. You just got to understand. I know you people outside of Texas, you think we're obnoxious, but you got to understand. When you're raised in the great state of Texas, you're probably 15 before you find out there are some other states out there, too. Okay, it's just the way we do it, all right? I blame my Texas pride on our former governor, former president George Bush. I was doing a documentary on President Reagan, and I was getting to interview all these people. And this was before I served with Bush while he was governor and I was a legislator. But before that, I was doing this deal on Reagan, and I went around the country and got to interview all these state and national leaders. And I went out to D.C. I was interviewing Trent Lott, Dick Cheney, a bunch of these guys that had been congressmen back in 81 during the tax cuts that led to the greatest peacetime economic expansion in history. And I'm asking him about all this. I'm interviewing Dick Cheney. Now, I have no idea the man's going to become vice president. This is like 94, 95. I had no idea he was going to turn into Darth Vader. Didn't know any of this stuff. Which I like Dick Cheney and I like Darth Vader, so that never bothered me when they called him that. But anyway, so I'm interviewing Dick Cheney, former Secretary of Defense under Bush 41. He'd been a congressman in 81. And I happen to notice he's got this white phone on his desk with a halo on it. Never seen one of these. I didn't know what it was. I said, Mr. Secretary, what's with the phone? He said, son, that's a direct line to God. I said, really? I said, can I use it? He said, yeah, but pay me back. That thing's $500 a minute. Made the call, paid him, got back to Texas. Now I'm sitting in the governor's office. I'm interviewing George Bush. He's got a white phone with a halo. I said, "Governor, could I use your direct line to God while I'm here?" He said, "Yeah, but pay me back. So I'm that thing $5 a minute." I said, "Governor, wait. I was with the Secretary of Defense." I said, "Man, that's all the states. $500 a minute. You're governor of one state telling me it's only $5. He said, "Boy, you've forgotten where you are." He said, "This is Texas, God's country, local call from Austin right here. So it's a little cheaper." So that's kind of the way we are, all right? So you're just going to have to forget about that. I tell you what, we're not going to agree on how great Texas is. Maybe we can agree on this one. As proud as I am to be a Texan, I'm even more proud to be an American. Will you agree with me on that? All right, now look, I didn't say that to get y'all, you know, Pollyanna, just waving the flag to feel good. I think it's important for us to understand when we wave the American flag, why that flag is worthy of being waved. What does it stand for? What does it mean? What are these values that we say we're proud of? What are these values that we're willing to fight for, willing to die for? What is it that is so special about being an American? And if you go back in history to the founding fathers, if you go back to what these guys actually gave us, when they gathered in that rented room we now call Independence Hall, that created a very special system. And from the beginning, we've been willing to sacrifice. And I want to take you backwards to 9/11 in New York City. New York is under attack. And it's not the 9/11 that you're thinking of. Uh-oh, my slides disappeared. What happened there? We still there? We are having technical difficulties. Did I do that? I blew it up. It means I'm going to have to use a lot of sign language. I'm going to draw pictures. There we go. All right, thank you. Okay, so anyway, we're going back to 9/11. It's not the 9/11 that you're thinking, just, you know, 11 years ago. I want to take you back to 9/11. New York City is under attack, but this is all the way back to 1776. And the scene that I want to take you back to is outside of New York City. And what has happened is the British have attacked at Staten Island. They defeated us at Long Island. They pushed Washington back to Manhattan. Washington has dug in. He's trying to figure out what to do next. He's trying to figure out how to not lose all of New York. He knows that he needs to know where the troop movements are. He needs to know where the British fortifications are. Without any of that information, he cannot defend New York City. What George Washington needs is a spy. But this was not like today. You know, I mean, often when you think about today in terms of spy, and by the way, just to put this in context, this is not towards the end of the war. This is at the very beginning of the war. And if you think about what Washington's facing, I mean, only 2 months before, I guess 2.5 months before, we had the Declaration of Independence. So here we have decided that we're going to take on the greatest military on the planet. We have very little to show for it, but there's no turning back. He's been able to free Boston. He's finally taken that ragtag bunch and turning it into a genuine fighting force. But now all eyes are on New York City. And as Washington's trying to figure out what to do, he knows he needs a spy. But the problem is it's not like today. See, today when we think of spy, what do we think of? Man, we're thinking about that well-dressed super soldier, right? We're thinking about that smooth talking. They can pull anything off. I mean, they got the gadgets to be able to accomplish any mission impossible. These guys can even run down the side of a mile-high building without any problem. And even if they don't have their gadgets, friend, they'll just take you out with a toothpick or a paperclip or a magazine. All the while, never losing their cool. Taking their martini shaken, not stirred. I mean, these guys are cool today, right? Not so in 1776, man. You go back to 1776, if you were a spy, you were the lowest of the low. You were the dregs of society. You weren't in the military. You weren't a military hero. You were a hired gun. You weren't trusted by no one. You were hung up on capture. And George Washington could not trust this mission to that type of man. Washington needed one of his officers to step up and volunteer. He wasn't going to demand such a demeaning and dangerous mission of one of them, but he needed one of them to step up and volunteer. So as we go back in our time machine, the scene that I'm taking you back to is the tent of Colonel Tom Knowlton. And inside this tent, these officers have gathered, and in hushed tones, they're talking about what the general needs. They're talking about the need of the mission, and Colonel Knowlton's trying to get a volunteer, and nobody's willing. In fact, one of the guys finally speaks up and he says, "I'm willing to be shot in battle. I'm not willing to be hung like a dog. There was no honor in being captured as a spy. Your reputation was ruined. There was honor in dying on the battlefield." And so Knowlton turns to leave and tell the general that he's failed. And this young man steps forward from the door of the tent. He's arrived in the meeting late. He was ill with a fever, but he was eager to serve. And that young man steps forward and he says, "I will undertake the mission." Now, to really understand what's taking place here, you've got to recognize this is not your ordinary group of officers. Young man at the door of that tent was not just any soldier. These guys in that tent were Colonel Tom Knowlton's Rangers. These were the very first Army Rangers, Pastor. These were your predecessors. And the only way I know to really be able to comprehend these incredible warriors back then, you know, I think in terms of 2012. So to take us back to Rangers back then, I want you to think Chuck Norris, but with a ponytail, all right? That's the only way to really capture the moment, okay? And so here we are at this tent, and we got all these Chuck Norrises with ponytails, and the fella at the door is none other than Captain Nathan Hale, 21 years old, a graduate of Yale at 18, at the top of his class, studied for the ministry. But he went to teach first in New London, Connecticut. And as he's teaching there in New London, Connecticut, Lexington and Concord happened on April 19, 1775. He's still in his teens at the time, but he's a member of the local militia. And so he shows up at the town hall meeting where they're going to decide how do we respond to Lexington and Concord. And he stands up and as a teenager says to his fellow citizens, he says, we should take up arms and march and not lay down those arms until we've achieved independence. Independence. Why, the word independence had not even been uttered publicly in that town until that moment. But this 19-year-old shakes this community from its colonial submission. Then he marches off to war, but not before he shakes the hand of every one of his students and prays with them. Now it's a year and a half later, and he finds himself outside the tent of Colonel Tom Knowlton. His buddy's out there with him. His name is William Hull, Captain William Hull, and he'd gone to Yale with Hale, and he's trying to convince him not to do it. He says, first of all, it's impossible, all right? The odds of achieving this mission are virtually impossible. Secondly, you're going to be a terrible spy. He said, look, you're a great speaker, you were great in debate, but you're no good at lying. There's no way you're going to be a good spy. You're going to fail. And even if you succeed, your reputation's ruined, your family's reputation's ruined. He said, there's no honor in this mission. Nathan Hale responded, according to William Hull later in his writings, he said, there's honor in any mission necessary for the cause. Duty demands, and I will do my duty. So he dresses once again as a teacher. He sneaks across enemy lines. He poses as an educator trying to find work. And for a week, he maps out the positions of the British. He finds all their fortifications, their movements, all the information that Washington needed. He gets it all on paper. He stuffs it down in his shoe. And before he can get across enemy lines once again, he's captured. The evidence right there on his person. I mean, there's no denying what he's there for. So he's instantly sentenced to hang. The hanging will take place the next morning, and so that night he's contemplating his fate. He's thinking about the fact that, look, I failed my mission, I failed my general, I failed the cause that I love so much. He asked for a member of the clergy. He's denied. He asked for a Bible. He's denied. He's finally given a couple of pieces of paper. He begins to write letters back home to his family, and in the process, he purposes within his heart to do the one thing left that he can do for the cause that he loves so much. And the next morning, they're marching him out to take his life. And a crowd is gathered to watch the hanging. And so they give him a chance to say his last words. And Nathan Hale reaches back into that oratory from college. And he begins to give an impassioned speech in defense of American freedom. 21 years old. And if you look at the different sources of all the different people that commented on what he said, he must have given a long speech because so many different things were said about what he said that morning. But as he's speaking, these British soldiers are heckling him. They're mocking him. They're saying, you're wasting your life. You're throwing your life away on a cause that cannot succeed. You're wasting your life. And of course, Nathan Hale, quoting or paraphrasing from Joseph Addison's Cato, he sums it all up by saying, I only regret that I have but one life to give for my country. One life to give. Some said he said, I have one life to lose. Some said, I have one life to give. The point is, he was willing to lose to give his life for freedom, for you and for me. And those words would be repeated over and over and over again. Those that were already serving were willing to re-up as they were inspired. Others were willing to join. And he accomplished far more in giving his life than he ever could have by getting that reconnaissance back to Washington. We've heard those words repeated over and over and over again throughout our history, inspiring generation after generation. One life to give. Friends, I don't care if you're 8 or you're 80. Each one of us tonight, we have one life to give. My challenge to you tonight is to ask you, for what will you give your one life? What are you willing to invest in? What are you willing to give of your time and your energy and your money? What are you willing to say, of my life, I will dedicate my time, energy, and money to these things that will make a difference? Fortunately for us in America, from the beginning, that first generation of Americans and guys like Nathan Hale, through every generation of Americans to guys like Navy SEAL Michael Murphy, we have had always enough in every generation willing to say, I will give my one life for you. And generations of Americans have done it for you and I. So we could be here tonight, so I could speak freely tonight. So this morning we could worship as we choose. Those freedoms that we hold so dear would not be here if it wasn't for those that came before us, sacrificing over and over again to preserve our freedom. And it boggles the mind when you think about the numbers. 1.2 million that have paid the ultimate price for us so we could be free tonight. I don't know how to respond to that. I don't know how to say thank you to that. You know, I teach my kids when you meet somebody in uniform at the airport or wherever, you go up and you shake their hand and you say thank you for your service, and that's great, but it just seems so empty to me. It's like it's not enough when I think these people are willing to die for my freedom, and all I can say is thank you. And I've been kind of in this conundrum trying to figure out, okay, what do you do? These people are willing to pay the ultimate sacrifice, and the Bible tells us that there's no greater love that any man has than that he's willing to lay down his life for, in this case, not only his friends, but his family and his country, whether it's those that are serving us in the military, our first responders out on the front lines. I mean, whoever it is, they're willing to give their life for us. How do we thank them? How do we honor their sacrifice? You think about James Bradley's book, Flags of Our Fathers. My wife's grandfather got his Purple Heart at Iwo Jima, and Bradley talked about that makeshift monument that said, when you go home, tell them for us and say, for your tomorrow, we gave our today. We gave our one life for you. And I think, how do I honor that? And finally, I was thinking about that biblical command to render honor unto whom honor is due. I said, how do I do that? And I was actually sitting watching a movie. I don't know if you ever saw this movie, Saving Private Ryan. How many of y'all saw Saving Private Ryan? Anybody see that? Okay. You remember the storyline, right? I mean, Private Ryan is 19 years old. His brothers have all been killed in action, and he's the last surviving son. The Army figures this out. They want to get him back home to his family as the last surviving son. So Tom Hanks' character is Captain Miller. And Captain Miller and his team are given the responsibility to find Private Ryan and get him out of the theater, get him back home. And so throughout the movie, they're trying to find Ryan, and they keep getting knocked off. I mean, they're giving their lives. They're dying for Private Ryan. So each and every one of them continue to give their lives for Private Ryan. And finally, at the end of the movie, they find him. They're just about to get him out, and Captain Miller gets killed. And just before he dies, this 19-year-old kid's right there next to him. He grabs him. He pulls him in real close, and he said two words, not only to Private Ryan, but to every one of us. He said, earn this. Earn this. Then that scene morphed only as Hollywood can do it, and that 19-year-old Private Ryan suddenly became 70, 75-year-old Private Ryan, and he's gone back to visit, and he's standing over the grave of Captain Miller. He kneels down, and he says to Captain Miller, he says, tell me I'm a good man. Tell me I've lived a good life. Tell me I've lived a life worthy of the sacrifice that you made for me. Earn this. I think it's time for our generation to earn the freedom that we've been given, to honor the sacrifice of those that came before us. How do you do that? Lincoln told us. He said that it is from these honored dead that we take increased devotion to the cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth. So how do we honor? Lincoln said that we take increased devotion to the cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. So our job is to be devoted to the cause for which they were willing to die. What were they willing to die for? What is this system of freedom that our founding fathers gave us? Well, they summed it up right there in our birth certificate, right there in the Declaration of Independence. 56 words found in the heart of the Declaration. It's what I call the frame of America. It's the frame that is holding your picture in place. You might have a different picture you'd throw up there, but it may be your family, maybe it be your church, your schools, your community, whatever it is. Know this, if the frame goes, your picture is going with it. My picture is going with it. That frame is holding it in place. And it's incumbent upon us as citizens to understand what's in the frame so that we can do our part to preserve and protect it. They told us that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their... Doesn't say commissioner, does it? Doesn't say state representative, doesn't say governor, certainly doesn't say Supreme Court justice. We're endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Right there you have the frame of America. Four quick points I want to make out of there. First of all, they believed in truths, moral absolutes, right and wrong, not moral relativism. See, a lot of people today, they say, well, you know, it might be wrong for me, but it doesn't mean it's wrong for you, and it would be wouldn't be right for me to say that something's always right, because then it might conflict with your particular values, and that just wouldn't be fair. Or that wouldn't be if they were to write the Declaration today. Newt says it better than anybody. He says if they were to write the Declaration today, they'd probably say, "Being randomly gathered protoplasm, we've considered for the moment that if it doesn't offend any particular special interest group, we might try." That's not what they said, is it? They said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." Truths means right and wrong. I like how Washington put it. He said, "Of all the habits and dispositions which lead to political prosperity." In other words, of all the pieces of the American formula, of all the pieces of the formula that will make you successful as a nation. And if you think about a nation, you don't become the wealthiest nation on the planet by accident. There's a cause for that effect. You don't become the most powerful nation on the planet by accident. There's a cause for that effect. If you change the formula that has produced the American success, you're going to get a different result. And so what Washington said was, of all the pieces of that formula, of all the habits and dispositions which lead to political prosperity, he said, religion and morality are indispensable supports. He said, you can't get rid of them. A lot of people, my friends today, you know, they'll say, "Rick, man, I'm with you on liberty. I'm with you on freedom, and I'll fight for freedom." But would you stop talking about God? Would you stop bringing the Bible into this? I don't need any of that. I don't need God in this thing. I can be a patriot without any of that. I say, well, you know, I could make an argument for that. That man right there would disagree with you, though. Because the next sentence in his speech, he said, "In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism that would work to subvert these great pillars." What great pillars? Religion and morality. Why? Because he understood that if you destroy religion and morality in a nation, you lose liberty. You cannot have liberty without morality. You cannot have morality without religion. And the reason he knew this, he's watching the French Revolution take place. He's seeing the result of liberty without God. See, the American formula said liberty from God, liberty under God, liberty with God. The French Revolution was all about liberty without God. They killed the priest, right? They said, everybody do whatever feels good. Finger to the wind, whatever's popular at the time. That's how the French Revolution worked. And what did it lead to? The guillotine. It led to total chaos, mob rule. It did not work, and Washington knew that. So he understood the difference between liberty without God and liberty with God. And that's why he said, you want to be a true patriot, you better protect religion and morality in our formula. That's why you got to have truths. You got to have those moral absolutes. So look, I'm all about revolution with ballots, not bullets, right? I mean, we have a beautiful system in America where if we don't like what Washington, D.C. is doing, or we don't like what our state capitals are doing, we can revolt as citizens by simply showing up and voting, by simply participating in the process. So we want revolution, yes. Just not the French kind, okay? We don't want the kind that leads to chaos. We want to make sure that our revolution is based upon those founding principles America first started with. So, second thing out of the frame is consent of the governed. That means you're in charge. That means you're the boss. That means that our public servants can only do what we want them to if we're engaged in the process. But we have to be willing to get off the back pews of our churches, stand up and say, I give my consent or I refuse my consent. The system works, but we have to work the system. I like the way President Garfield put it. He was a pastor as well. President Garfield said, now more than ever before, the people are responsible for the character of their Congress. He said, if that body be ignorant, reckless, and corrupt. Just picture Barney Frank right now. That'd be a fine way to really get this across. If that body be ignorant, reckless, and corrupt, it's because the people tolerate ignorance, recklessness, and corruption. He said if it be intelligent, brave, and pure, it's because the people demand these high qualities to represent them in the national legislature. If the next centennial does not find us a great nation, it'll be because the people who represent the enterprise, the culture, and the morality of the nation, that's us right here in this room, because we do not aid in controlling the political forces. You know what he's saying? He's saying it's up to you.
Yeah.
He's saying the buck stops with you. He's saying it's not enough to scream at the TV. Anybody else been doing that? Right? It's not enough to complain around the dinner table. We have to get up, get engaged, and work the system. Live the freedom that others were willing to die for. You want to honor the sacrifice of those that came before us? You live the freedom they were willing to die for. What does it say to them when we don't even live the freedom they died for? If I don't take 5 minutes to stop off at the polls and vote, what does that say to the people that died for my right to vote? Consent of the governed is our job as citizens. We've got to be engaged in this process. Now, I'm not going to spend any time on this one tonight, but pursuit of happiness is our free enterprise system. It's the idea that you leave government out of the marketplace and let the market decide. Let people decide what they want, how much they're willing to pay for it, and the market forces will produce a far better result been introducing the government into the market. Thomas Jefferson said it better than anybody. He said, a wise and frugal government which shall leave men free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement and shall not take from the mouth of labor bread it has earned. This is the sum of good government. Jefferson just said that deregulation and low taxes, that's the sum of good government, all right? So we'll leave that one alone for now. Let's go to the Creator, because this is where I want to spend the rest of our time together. The idea that God is not only in our equation of freedom, He's at the center of our equation of freedom. We don't have true freedom without God in the equation. A lot of people don't like that. They don't want God in the equation. They don't even want to talk about God being in the equation. They say, we're not a nation under God. We were never intended to be a nation under God. Founding fathers wouldn't have wanted that. And in fact, some people say, we'll have more liberty if there's no religion involved, if God's not in the equation. And I've been thinking about that. You know, we could try that. I mean, we could start our own little commune right here. We could put our whole new society together right here. We'll all put on our tie-dye shirts. We'll go stand around the trees and hold hands, sing kumbaya. Look at each other and say, I love you and you love me and I'll confer freedom upon you and you confer freedom upon me and we'll live happily ever after, right? No. There's this thing called the depravity of man. And sooner or later, there's going to be a group among us become stronger than the rest and they'll start taking away our freedom. What can we do? Not much, because if your freedom comes from your neighbor can take it away. If your freedom comes from government, government can take it away. What the founding fathers of America said is that we have equal protection for all because it comes from a higher source. If you take God out of the equation of freedom, you have no true freedom. So keeping God in the equation is fundamental. But you say, well, but the founding fathers didn't want God in the equation. I mean, these guys were all atheists and agnostics and deists. We had an un-Christian beginning in America, we're told. I mean, we hear it all the time in the media and academia that these guys were all irreligious. They hated Christianity. They hated church. They hated all those things, right? And I hear that stuff, and then I go, instead of listening to what some professor says that they said, I actually go read the founding fathers themselves. I get a very different picture. If I actually go back to their letters, their correspondence, their speeches, their laws that they put in place, it's amazing how different the perception is. In fact, here's Adams. I mean, this is the guy that pushed the Declaration through. We wouldn't have a Declaration of Independence if it wasn't for John Adams. He said the general principles upon which the founders achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. Wait. We're founded on Christian principles. You fast forward to where we are today, and you can't even mention the name Jesus Christ at a public school graduation? I mean, think about it. 3 years ago, over in Nevada, a young lady gets up. She's given her valedictorian address. She begins to talk about her faith in Jesus Christ. They turn the microphone off on her. Will not let her utter the words, Jesus Christ. Same year at Colorado, a young lady gets up. She's given her valedictorian address. I don't know why the women are always the valedictorians, but it sure seems like that. So this girl is giving her speech, and guys, it's because they're smarter than us, just accept it. Okay, so this girl's giving her speech, and she's about halfway through, she starts talking about Jesus. And they can't get to the microphone fast enough, so she's able to finish what she was going to say about Jesus. So afterwards, they require her to issue a public apology before she can have her diploma for mentioning the name of Christ at a public school graduation. Now, friend, how did we go from a founding on Christian principles to not even being able to say his name in a public school graduation? We don't know our history. We don't know what these guys actually said and did. We don't know what they believed. We don't know what their actions were. So the Supreme Court comes along and says, well, founding fathers didn't want prayer in schools. Okay. Founding fathers didn't want the Bible in school. Okay. Founding fathers didn't want public expressions of faith, only private. Well, that's the nine geniuses, right? I mean, they're supposed to know more about the law and the Constitution and the founding fathers than anybody else. So if the Supreme Court says, it must be so. See, what we need to do is stop listening to the experts of today and start going back to the original documents, going back and reading these guys. You get a very different picture. Now, I'm going to try to capture them for you tonight. We don't have a lot of time to do it. 250 founding fathers. I think we can be done by midnight, if that works. Everybody's schedule. Okay, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to cover as many as we can, but this is why David Barton and I both get accused of talking about 90 words a minute with gust up to about 350, because I'm going to gust on up to 350 and try to squeeze in as many guys as I can. I've been going really slow up until now. So we're going to dive in here, and if I go too fast, the good news is it's all on that DVD out there. The bad news, that DVD, just as fast as what we're about to do. So hopefully you know where rewind is on your DVD player. Let's start with that fellow right there, Father of the Country. Now, George Washington, any founding father, you want to know whether or not they're a man of faith, real simple. Go talk to their friends. Go read the journals of the people that spent time with them. Go read their correspondence back and forth. You know, these guys wrote letters to each other the way you and I text each other today. I mean, thousands and thousands, volumes of letters. We can do that. We can get inside their heads. General Henry Knox served with Washington throughout the Revolutionary War, talks over and over in his journal about how he walked in on General Washington, accidentally interrupted the general. Guess what he's doing? He's praying. Same thing happens with Secretary Thompson there in Congress. Secretary Thompson says, walks in on President Washington, accidentally interrupting him. Guess what he's doing? It's the same answer every time if y'all want to help me out here. Yeah, he's praying. Then you go to Valley Forge there in Pennsylvania, big bronze monument of George Washington. What's he doing? Down the street, stained glass window of George Washington. He's kneeling in prayer. You go to the Capitol right now in Washington, D.C. That's the stained glass window in the private prayer room of our congressman. And it's George Washington kneeling in prayer. You've all seen the paintings of Washington kneeling in prayer. I mean, I'm just amazed that an atheist founding father spent that much time praying. I mean, if we Christians would pray half as much as these atheist founding fathers, we'd be a lot better off, don't you think? All right, but it's not just Washington. It's guys like Gouverneur Morris. I mean, here's a guy that used to be in every textbook in America. Can't find him anymore because he's not politically correct. But he's the most active man at the Constitutional Convention. Not only did he sign the document, this is the guy that put the wording in place. This is the guy that wrote the preamble entirely by himself. This is the guy that stood up and influenced it more than anybody. 173 times he rose to speak there at the Constitutional Convention. I was just 2 weeks ago doing my Constitution class in that room, in Independence Hall, where the Constitution was framed, and I'm standing there, and I'm thinking, man, that's where Gouverneur Morris actually stood up every time when he spoke, and there's where Benjamin Franklin said. It was amazing to be there, but this guy influenced the document more than anybody. Here's why you don't get to read about him anymore. He's not politically correct. He said, religion is the only solid basis of good morals. Therefore, education should teach the precepts of religion and the duties of man towards God. And say, wait, hang on now. Supreme Court says education and religion, we got to keep those as far apart as possible because of the Constitution. I'm just wondering if it's the same Constitution that this guy gave us. Because he's saying, make sure that we got education and religion working together. That's why your school here is doing exactly what Gouverneur Morris said that we should do. Have those two working together. Same thing when it comes to the law and religion. James Wilson here is the second most active member of the convention. And since my horns won yesterday, we're going to do second and 11 like this all night. And then we're going to close with the eyes of Texas. All right, that's how tonight's going to work. So I didn't clear that with the pastor, so I'm not sure I'll be able to get away with that. But anyway, so I keep fighting this mic, sorry. So Wilson speaks 168 times. So real close to the same number as Gouverneur Morris, influenced the document a lot. He also signed the Declaration of Independence. So he signs the Constitution 11 years before he signs the Declaration. He serves on the Supreme Court. So he's an original Supreme Court justice. Both are founding documents. You're not going to find a better expert than James Wilson. Here's what he said. Human law, that's our civil law. That's what our Congress passes. That's what our city councils pass. That's what our legislature passes. He says, human law must rest its authority ultimately upon the authority of that law which is divine. He said, far from being rivals or enemies, religion and law are twin sisters, friends, mutual assistants. Indeed, these two sciences run into each other, meaning they're working together side by side like a couple of oxen pulling to give us a good culture and a good society. Religion and law, they're supposed to work together. That's why when friends of mine say, well, you know, Rick, you can't define marriage as one man and one woman. Why, that's bringing the Bible into government. I've been working on my response. Tell me what you think. I think it really works well. Yep. Somebody out there already had my response. Who was that? You've been reading my notes, haven't you? Get that man a cookie. He's way ahead of me here. I mean, who cares what Rick Green thinks? But I do care what James Wilson thinks. And if he says that our human law should be based on our higher law, then that means what your pastor's preaching on Sunday morning ought to influence, if you're a legislator in this church, what you're learning from the Bible ought to influence your position and your belief system. If you're a voter, it ought to influence your position and your belief system. And then you ought to influence government and our laws in that way. You don't check your religion at the door. Your religion should influence and impact every decision that you make, all the way Sunday through Saturday, not just on Sunday. Now, I bet you recognize these fellas here. That's the 56 atheists that signed the Declaration of Independence. Of course, that's what we're told. They're not only atheists, they're enemies of Christ. Enemies of Christ. I've been thinking about this one. Now, if it's 2012 and you're an enemy of Christ, you know, today there's a lot of stuff you can get into, right? I mean, there's plenty of trouble today that an atheist can get into in America. But what if you're one of these guys and you live in 1776? I mean, what do you do if you're an enemy of Christ? Where do you go for fun? What are your hobbies? Let's find out what these enemies of Christ were doing in 1776. That fellow back in the corner, that's the Reverend Dr. John Witherspoon. A pastor in Congress? 29 of the 56 signers held what we would call today seminary degrees. That's pretty good to get a bunch of atheist enemies of Christ to go to seminary. I'm sure they were just doing some opposition research on this Jesus guy they heard of. I'm sure that's all that was going on there. Witherspoon, they're responsible for two American translations of the Bible, and you're looking at the Billy Graham of that day. Best known evangelist throughout the colonies at the time. And he's in Congress. He's given us the Declaration of Independence. Here we have Secretary Thompson responsible for the Thompson Bible. Spent 25 years of his life translating the Greek Septuagint into English. Pretty interesting activity for an atheist enemy of Christ, don't you think? Over here we have Benjamin Rush. He started the first Bible society in America, known as the Philadelphia Bible Society. Now, why would you start a Bible society? What's the purpose of a Bible society? Help me out. Print Bibles? Distribute Bibles? What else? Study the Bible, maybe? What are a bunch of atheist enemies of Christ doing distributing Bibles and studying with the Bible? It doesn't make any sense. Rush also started the first abolition society in America. I don't know about you. When I was in law school, I was told, who cares what any of those guys think? They're all slave owners. Now that I've studied their lives, I know 3/4 of the guys you're looking at were trying to get rid of slavery from the beginning. Benjamin Rush, one of those, and Franklin. He and Franklin actually got together and started the Pennsylvania Abolition Society because we'd abolished slavery in 3 states, and King George vetoed all the laws, says you're keeping slavery whether you want it or not. So these two guys said, in an act of civil disobedience, we're going to start this abolition society, and if we can get independence, we'll get rid of slavery. So that was their main reason for fighting for independence. Obviously, it didn't work. We weren't able to get rid of it in the beginning. It took 100 years to get it right. But the principles that these guys put right there in the Declaration of Independence, that's what Lincoln stood upon with the Emancipation Proclamation. That's what MLK stood upon in the Civil Rights Movement. The principles were right, and a lot of these guys were on the right side of it from the beginning as well. But we don't know so much about it. In fact, I had another misperception of these guys. I thought it was a bunch of rich white guys that got us our independence, and that was it. You know some of the greatest heroes of the Revolutionary War were black patriots? Nobody talks about them anymore. The hero of Bunker Hill was a guy named Peter Salem. He was a black patriot. 13 military commendations for what he did that day. You always see that painting of Washington crossing Delaware, and everybody talks about it. In the front of the boat, there's two black patriots named Prince Whipple and Oliver Cromwell. Nobody talks about those guys, soldiers that served throughout the Revolutionary War. My favorite guy, though, one of my favorite heroes from the Revolutionary War. Remember how I talked about Nathan Hale, and we didn't have any good spies in the beginning? I mean, we had no CIA, there was no MI6, there was no Mossad, I mean, none of that. By the end of the war, though, man, we had some pretty good spies, some really cool guys. One of the coolest was a double agent by the name of James Armistead. See, Lafayette had figured out, he said, man, we're not going to win anything if we don't develop a good team of spies. We got to get some intelligence on these guys. We need some people that can go spy on the British. And so he goes to his friend James Armistead. He says, Armistead, I need somebody that can get over there and get inside the highest ranks of the British camp. And Armistead does it. He goes to the British. He says, I'm a runaway slave. I want to help you guys defeat the Americans. They bought it hook, line, and sinker. They bring him in. He works his way all the way up to the top. He's spying on these guys, getting all kinds of good stuff, taking it back to Lafayette. We finally use some of that information, start winning some stuff. And the British start saying, man, these Americans are getting a lot smarter. These Americans are starting to win some battles. They said, you know what we really need is we need some intelligence. They said, we need some spies. That's what we need. Who do we know that could go spy on those Americans? Hey, Armistead. Hey, would you go spy on those Americans? You know where you're... No, man, don't send me back to those Americans. No, we really need... You know where to... No, I'm not going. No, we really need you. All right, I guess I could do that for you. So now Armistead has free passage back and forth, right? Now he's able to go to the Americans, give them all the good information. He comes back to the British, gives them a disinformation campaign. So he's the first double agent. He actually sets up Yorktown. We end up winning the war because this guy. We don't talk about any of these guys anymore. There's so much about our history we just don't know. But back to this faith thing and God being in the equation of our freedom. This is kind of my ShamWow part of the presentation, you know. That's where I say, but wait, there's more, because if you go to this painting right here, September 7, 1774, opening session of Congress. That's the first time the United States Congress ever met. Kind of looks like a revival to me. What do you think? Opening session of Congress. One of the guys got up. He said, you know, we should pray. I mean, this is very important. Another guy said, no, wait, we can't pray. I mean, we've got every denomination possible here. Somebody's going to be offended. Samuel Adams. Father of the American Revolution. I love this guy. He stands up. He says, I'm no bigot. I can pray with every man in this room. Let's pray. They began to pray. They brought in the Reverend Jacob Deshaies. They prayed for 3 hours, and they had a Bible study. John Adams here, he writes home to Abigail in his letter. He said, Abigail, God so spoke to us out of Psalms 35, we believe for the first time we can defeat the British. Tell everybody else. Study Psalms 35 and let God speak to them the same way that he did to us. Prayer and a Bible study by a bunch of atheists in Congress. Pretty good for atheists. Don't have time to do all 250 guys. I'll tell you what, 95% of the 250, outspoken Christians, lived it, talked it, wrote it, spoke it. There's no denying it. It's all documented for you out there. There are 10 guys I need to take off the table and say they're not Christians. 10 out of 250, 5% not Christians. That leaves me 95% that are, and we've allowed people to label the founding fathers as atheists, agnostics, and deists. to drive it home, I'm going to use one of the 10 I took off the table. And you could probably tell, I don't know, it may not be obvious, but the ACLU and I are usually not on the same page. Here's one where we are. We both agree that this man right here is one of our least religious founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin. But least is a relative term. Here's Franklin at the convention, the Constitutional Convention. Now, Franklin is 81 at the convention. I used to think 81 was old. I don't think that anymore. It's getting younger.
Amen.
And younger. And actually, I was with a congressman a few years ago that had just turned 81, and he was my congressman growing up. I mean, he's been there for a long time, and he had just turned 81, and we were doing an event, and he spoke first, and he's introducing me, and he says to me, this has been about 5 or 6 years ago, and he said, Rick, he said, I turned 81 last week. He said, I bet you think that's old. But he said, I went to Senator Strom Thurmond's 100-year birthday party. He said, Thurmond at that 100-year birthday party looked over at me and said, oh, to be 80 again. So 80 is young in America today, all right, is what I'm saying. 80 was not young in America back then. The average lifespan back then was 35. This guy's 81. When he speaks, everybody's going to listen. So the elder statesman gets up to save the day. It's June 28, 1787. If we go back in our time machine again to that particular day, this is about 5 weeks into the Constitutional Convention. Everything's falling apart. You got guys leaving now because it's just not going to happen. They've given up and the Constitution's not going to happen. So Benjamin Franklin's trying to save the day and keep everything together. So he starts off, he says, in the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. And I find that quote interesting because he's saying, in the beginning, we had prayer in this room. See, he's one of those six, like James Wilson, that signed both the Declaration and the Constitution. Only six of them. So at the Constitutional Convention, he can say to the other guys in the room, he can say, look, I was in here. I was in this same room 11 years ago when we didn't have a chance. He said, we knew we needed God on our side. And then he reminded them what happened. Now think about it. We're only 11 years old as a nation. And we already needed a history lesson because we'd been ignoring our history. Here's what he reminded them of. He said, our prayers were heard. And they were graciously answered. All of us engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. Then he asked the question that America needs to ask today. Have we now forgotten this powerful friend? Mm. Or do we imagine we no longer need his assistance? I've lived so long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth that God governs in the affairs of men. You know this part, if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We've been assured in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babylon. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayer imploring the assistance of heaven and his blessing on our deliberation be held in this assembly, but only once and in private, because if the ACLU finds out, they might sue us and we'll all be in trouble. Just making sure you're still with me. That's not what he said, is it? What'd he say? Every morning before we... Wait. This is our least religious founding father? If I gave you the whole speech, friends, he quotes about 11 different verses from the Bible, and that's our least religious. But he sounds like a Bible-thumping evangelical. He's taking the Bible out, hitting the other guys over the head with, and he's one of the 10 that I took off the table. If he's our least religious, man, these other guys, I'm telling you, there's no question they wanted a public, not only private, but a public expression of faith. Of course, the courts have been removing that for about 50 years now. They started in 1962, a case called Engle v. Vitale. They said, no more voluntary prayer in our schools. The very next year, it was Abington v. Shemp, Murray v. Collette. No more Bible in our schools. That's the Aiken Bible there. And they said, we don't even want it in our schools. Our founders certainly wanted the Bible in schools. Benjamin Rush, we talked about. I mean, Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration of Independence, started our public school system under the Constitution. He said, if we'll just teach everybody the Bible, we can get rid of slavery, solve crime, all these problems. They wanted the Bible in the classrooms. Now you can't even pray at a football game. Pledge of Allegiance, supposedly unconstitutional. Ten Commandments. They said, oh no, if you put the Ten Commandments on the wall in a school, a Supreme Court case called Stone v. Graham, they said, the kids might see them. If they see them, well, they might read them. And if they read them, they might study them. And if they study them, they might obey them, and this would violate the Establishment Clause. Really? Don't kill, don't steal? Kind of sounds like a pretty good idea, don't you think? But instead, what did we do? We changed two things in education in the last 50 years. Number one, we said no more right and wrong. No more moral absolutes, more relativism for all. Might be wrong for me, not necessarily for you. Everybody do what's right in your own eyes. Do whatever feels good to you. Oh, second thing we changed, we said that student next to you there, oh, they're just an accident. They're just a pile of atoms. They're just randomly gathered protoplasm. They're not a created being. They're not a child of God. You do whatever feels good to you. Then we're shocked that a student can walk into a classroom, take out a gun, murder a classmate. We put the formula in place, friends. Now we get Paducah, Pearl, Jonesboro, Littleton, the list goes on and on and on. About every 3 months, we have another school shooting in America buried on the back page, not even news anymore, because it's part of our culture. The gun is not the problem, friends. I can take out my .40 caliber Glock and I can set it down here. We can all stand around it and hold hands and chant all night long. It will not jump up and shoot anybody. Right? The gun's not the problem. Guns don't kill people. Chuck Norris kills people. That's the other part of that phrase there. Now look, the gun is not the problem. What's the problem? The heart of man. The depravity of man. And if you take God out of the equation of freedom and you leave men unto themselves, this is the result. Happens every time. It's happened every time in history. And Jefferson knew it. All the founding fathers knew it. That's why Jefferson said, can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we remove their only firm basis? What did he say was the firm basis of liberty? A conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they're not to be violated, but with his wrath. Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and his justice cannot sleep forever. Jefferson is saying, if you forget that God's the source of your freedom, then your actions will become different. You'll no longer live out your freedom respecting his authority. See, if my freedom comes from God, I have to act a certain way with that freedom. I have to accept the responsibility that comes with it, the boundaries that come with it. But if freedom's just innate, if I'm just born with it and I get to do anything with it I want, then there are no rules. I can do anything I want. Jefferson understood you need God in the equation. That's the part of the frame that we've been pushing away, that we've been trying to get God out of the system. The founders knew our system of liberty and freedom requires that God be in the equation of freedom. And it is our job in the church to return God to the equation of America's freedom. We have a responsibility as citizens to participate in a way that will return God. I think the way that Charles Finney put it is probably better than anybody else. He was a speaker in the Second Great Awakening. This is not John Travolta. I know there's confusion with this slide. It's, you know. But now we know where Staying Alive actually came from. It was the Second Great Awakening. So Finney said this. He said, the church must take right ground in regard to politics. Politics are part of a religion in a country such as this, and Christians must do their duty to their country as a part of their duty to God. He said, God will bless or curse this nation according to the course Christians take in politics. You know what he's saying? He's saying in our system of government, when we say, you know, Jesus said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's, not or. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and well, who is Caesar in America? Who's Caesar? Who said that? We are. Get that man a cook. But you've been passing out my notes. What's the deal? All these people know. You're exactly right, brother. We are. You're Caesar in America. So how do you render unto Caesar what is Caesar's in America? You do your job as a citizen under the Constitution. You fulfill your duty and responsibility and your role as Caesar in America by being we the people. It's like the parable of the talents, folks. We've been given the talents. Now, you might be the one that got, you know, only one. You might be getting two. You might get five. I mean, however many you've been given freedom. And the question is, what are you doing with it? Are you living it? Are you participating in it? Are you investing in it? Are you multiplying it? Or have you buried it and you're doing nothing with it? And therefore, the master will say, wicked and slothful servant. See, we've been given a special form of government. And the Bible tells us when the righteous rule the people, rejoice. When the wicked rule the people, groan. In America, who chooses whether we're going to be ruled by the righteous or the wicked? We do. We the people get to choose a right that most people who ever lived on the planet did not have. So here's my challenge to you. Live it. Live the freedom that others were willing to die for. Don't take it for granted. Don't be a leech on society that just enjoys the blessings of liberty but never accepts the burden and the responsibility that comes with it. Honor the sacrifice of those that came before us. You don't have to give as much as they did. They gave it all, friends. Lives, fortune, sacred honor. They didn't just pledge it. It wasn't just on paper. They gave it. They gave everything they had to light the torch of freedom and pass it to the next generation. Get that book, Lives of the Signers, and read their stories and teach them to your children and read the behind the scenes of what took place and then go out there and live it. How do you live it? Well, voting's obvious, right? I used to think it was obvious. You realize half of Christians aren't voting?
Right.
Not even registered to vote? If statistics are true, right here in this church congregation, at least 35% of the congregation that could be voting is not even registered to vote. That's the average across the country. I mean, actually, that's the best numbers. Usually it's 40 and 50%. And some people say, well, Rick, you know, one vote, it's not going to matter. Living proof is standing before you right now, okay? In 1998, when I ran for the legislature, 30,000 people voted. I lost by 20 votes. 20 votes! Now, I don't know about here, but where I live, that's an average-sized homeschool family. 20 votes is nothing. I mean, we homeschool, we got four, and all of our friends say, you know, like the Bates and the Duggars and all, they say, that's a nice start you got going there, Green. I mean, even the Duggars, how many of y'all watch 19 Kids and Counting? Anybody watch that? I called Jim Bob after I lost by 20 votes. I said, Jim Bob, if you just lived in my district, I'd have won. One family could have made all. In fact, the guy standing next to me on election night when they said, Rick, you lost by 20 votes. He said, 20 votes. He said, Rick, I could have got you 20 more votes. Huh. I wanted to lay hands on him without prayer at that moment. Let me tell you right now, not a good time to tell me that. So fortunately, we had a recount, found some hanging chads, and I ended up winning by 36 votes. Now, this is 1998, all right? This is before Florida, the 2000 presidential election. Nobody knows what a recount is or hanging. I win by 36 votes. I get this call the day after the recount. Well, guess who's governor of Texas in 1998? And the operator says, Representative-elect, we've got Governor Bush on the phone. Can you take the call? What would you do? Take that call, man. He gets on the phone. He says, Rick. He said, boy, that was close. He said, I'm officially dubbing you Landslide Green. He laughed, man. He thought that was funny in 1998. That wasn't so funny in 2000, was it? Had his own little recount to deal with at that point. So, but think about his recount. Think about the presidential race of 2000. 537 votes determined president of the United States. Don't tell me your vote doesn't count. Your vote counts every time. School board, city, I don't care if you homeschool, private school, public school, you go vote in those school board elections. City council, legislature, president, your state's a battleground state. You're going to have huge influence on who the next president is. Every chance you get to vote, you go vote. Don't be like some of my friends who say, Rick, I'm not voting this year. Nope. I will not vote for the lesser of two evils. I say, all right, you know, unless Jesus Christ is on the ballot, you're going to vote for the lesser of two evils. I seem to recall, there is none righteous, no, not one. Anybody else read that? We're all flawed jars of clay, folks. I have never found a candidate I agree with 100%. I don't even agree with myself 100% of the time. There's only one person on the planet I agree with 100% of the time. You know who it is? All the men said, your wife. Yeah, you got that right. Because whether she's right or wrong, she's right. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. The point is, you're never going to find the perfect candidate. There is no white knight that's going to come in and save the day. If Ronald Reagan was alive today, my hero, I named one of my kids after him. I got another kid born on his birthday. Used to have a dog named Dutch. I mean, I'm a Reagan fan, all right? But if Reagan were alive today, there's things I disagreed with his positions on. There's no perfect candidate. So you got to do what my mama said. She said, you do the best you can with what you got where you are. And then you work hard to have better candidates next time. That's all there is to it. You go in every time and say, okay, study, do your homework, find out which candidate. And by the way, please, don't go in and pull the Republican Party platform. Don't go in and pull the Democrat Party platform. When are we going to start saying it's not about the party, it's about the principles? When are we going to start saying it's not about do they agree with the Republican platform or the Democrat? It's do they agree with the Bible? That's what ought to be our standard, our guide. The Bible speaks to every issue of our day, every single one. Abortion, marriage, taxes, just war theory, all of those things are addressed by the Bible. So that ought to be how we measure our candidates. And we ought to measure them the way the Bible says. Exodus 18 says, choose out from among you able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness. They got to be able. They got to be capable of winning the election and capable of doing the job. So if you got two, and you only have two choices for president. Okay, I'm sorry, that's it. That's the way our system works, all right? There's not a third-party candidate that has any chance of winning. Therefore, they don't meet the biblical definition of able. I know I'm stepping on some toes. I apologize. My intent is to stomp on them. Because we've got to be strategic. We've got to be smart. We've got to do the best we can with the talents that we've been given. So you go in there and you say, well, I agree with one of them 65, 70, 80% of the time. I agree with the other one 5% of the time. And... it's good on fatherhood issues, okay? So then you go in and you do the best you can, and then you work hard to have a better option next time. See, here's our problem. We're like those people that show up at a party, and they complain about the options. You know, it's like, I don't like any of those desserts on the table. Where's the gooey, chewy chocolate chips? Those are no good. I mean, those kind of people drive me nuts. You know what? How about getting there early and getting in the kitchen and being part of mixing up the ingredients that provide the options for everybody else when they get there? That's what we need to do as citizens. You need to show up early, not just in November. We need to be working now on raising up a generation that's going to be running for office 20 years from now. We need to be working now. Recruiting candidates are going to be running in 2014, in 2016, 2018. See, if we'll take a long-term generational view the way that God said that we should do it, so that we understand incrementalism, then we can get our nation back on track. All right, I'm getting off on tangents. Vote, all right? Show up and vote and drag 10 people there with you. It is your duty and responsibility, and you owe it to those that sacrifice. Volunteer, find candidates you can support. Contribute. What are we talking about here? Lives, that's your time. Time to vote, time to study, time to campaign for people. Fortunes, yes. I'm asking you to give money to candidates, to causes like ACLJ and Alliance Defense Fund and Liberty Council and all these great organizations that fight for our religious liberty. Invest in freedom and then speak out. That's your sacred honor. Sacred honor means I'm willing to stand up and speak the truth with moral clarity and let the chips fall where they may. We need people like that in America today. Leaders that are, not just leaders, all of us that are willing to speak the truth. To do that, we got to know the truth. So we got to begin to study. Get David's book on the Founding Fathers' original intent, or my book, Freedom's Frame, will get you started on these on the principles out of the Declaration. Get the DVDs and open up your home and make it like the taverns of the Founding Era, where people came to discuss the issues of the day and talk about how to save the country and what to do. Make your home that place. Begin to study the Constitution. I mean, friends, this, you know, you could have just as easily awakened last night at 2 o'clock in the morning, being drug off to some sewer-like prison where you have no chance of survival. No judge, no hearing, no opportunity for counsel. That happens on this planet around the world right now. But it doesn't happen in our nation because of the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Sixth Amendments to this document right here. Okay? We don't realize how good we've got it. We're so spoiled. We are spoiled rotten. We've enjoyed our freedom for so long, we've forgotten that you need to be fighting for it, and you got to know the principles. And I'm going to tell you right now, you may think this is an exaggeration, but the fate of the free world depends on you. And you may think that's an exaggeration. My wife would probably say that's cheesy. She thinks I'm the king of Velveeta. But let me explain it, all right? How many of you would agree the fate of the free world depends on America? Do you agree with that? How many of you would agree that America depends upon her constitutional principles being upheld? Her constitutional principles depend upon the first three words of the document, which is what? We the people. So if the fate of the free world depends on America, if America depends on our constitutional principles, if our constitutional principles depend upon we the people, then friends, the fate of the free world depends on you. So you got to get busy studying the founding documents, finding out where we came from and what we've been about. We take you through all of that. We got a complete Constitution class so you can walk through the Constitution. And it's kind of like the quick start guide to the Constitution. You ever get a computer or TV back home, you know, from the store? It's got the big, thick manual. What do you usually do with that? Chuck it in the trash, right? I'm looking for that nice glossy fold out with pictures. You know, just shows me where to plug everything in. That's the one I want, right? Well, this is the quick start guide to the Constitution. It shows you how to plug everything in. How do we get the country back on track? What are the things that you and I need to do as citizens in order to preserve freedom for the next generation? That's why we give you the one I'm holding up. That's a Constitution made easy. Because the Constitution, I'll admit, it can be confusing. I mean, look, I remember in law school, I said, man, I'm going to figure out this electoral college thing. This school in the Northeast where all candidates go. I'm so glad y'all laughed, because in some places they're like, yeah, I've been wondering about that place. So that, Pastor, that speaks well of your community, man. You've been teaching them well. So, all right, that's right. So I wanted to go study the Electoral College. So I opened up Article 2. That's where the presidency is. And three paragraphs in, it says this has been amended by the 12th Amendment. But it doesn't tell me how. It just underlines a bunch of stuff. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm smart. I can figure this out. So I'm going to leave Article 2 open, and I'm going to compare it to the 12th Amendment. And then three paragraphs into the 12th Amendment, it says this has been amended by the 20th Amendment. All right, well, I can keep the 12th Amendment open while I got the 20th Amendment open and the Article 2, and I got to compare it, because it doesn't tell you how it's been amended or anything. Guess what? Article 2 is also amended by the 22nd, the 23rd, and the 25th. You got five amendments affecting, and it's just a confusing mess. So my buddy Mike Holler put this thing right here together called the Constitution Made Easy. I love it. I don't do a radio interview without it. This is a great tool. You get the original Constitution on the left, so we got the real original language. And on the right, you get the Constitution as amended. So all 27 amendments are incorporated into the language, and it's in modern language, so you can quickly read through. You can sit down and in 15 minutes read through the entire Constitution and know what your freedoms are and where they're found. We need to be studying the Constitution. It's our job to do so. And I tell you what, I want you to get your kids to study the Constitution. Just last Friday, I read this book. I'd never seen it before. A guy named David Bauman wrote it. I think he's from Utah. And man, I came unglued. I got on the phone with him. I said, I want the book. I want to carry it. He has done what I've been wanting to do for 15 years. I've been traveling around the country doing this. Because he found a way to be funny and humorous and entertaining and teach teens and preteens about the Constitution and the principles, and he talks about how God's got to be the foundation. I mean, anyway, I'm more excited about this book than anything I've ever written or anything David Barton's ever written or anything we've done. I'm telling you, this is going to help us raise up the next generation. So get it in the hands of your kids and make sure they're studying to know what their freedom's all about. Listen to Wall Builders Live. We're going to encourage you. We're not going to depress you like a lot of people today. There are people that are running around America right now saying, it's all over. Grab your guns and canned food. Go hide out at the ranch. They just impress everybody. They could light up this room by leaving. You know, they got it's like this black cloud follows them around everywhere they go. My friend Dr. Jarvis says they got mental B.O. I mean, they're just depressing to everybody. They're like you remember the 10 spies that came back from the promised land? They said, it's too hard. The giants are too big. We couldn't possibly win. The Bible says they depressed the people, and an entire generation had to die in the wilderness. Let's not be like that. Let's be like Joshua and Caleb, the other two spies. They saw the same thing, right? But they came back and their report was totally different. They said, giants? Oh, yeah. Huge giants. Fight? Oh, yeah. We're going to have to fight. It's going to be bloody. We're going to be in the trenches. It's going to be muddy. It's going to be tough. And it's going to be incremental. We're going to get a little bit at a time. But God has given us the land. Let's go take it. That's the way we need to be today. We need to recognize that God's given us a great nation. He's given us a system of freedom that we don't have to take up arms to save our country. We can do it peaceably. We got a wonderful system. If we'll just work the system, we can preserve freedom for the next generation. Be willing to do that. Get plugged in. Listen to the radio program. Get on Facebook and Twitter with us. Get on our email list. We will encourage you. There are great, great things happening all over the country right now. Wonderful things happening. There's a generation being raised up right now that gets it. They're passionate. They're articulate. That's what I mean when I say pass the torch. I'm talking about teaching your children and grandchildren about freedom. We do this thing that Pastor Sean was talking about, Patriot Academy. And it's a chance for 16 up to 25-year-olds to come to the state capitol in Austin, Texas with me and spend a week as a legislator. They live the life of a legislator. They learn biblical worldview of government. They learn speaking skills. They learn how to win. It's like being the men of Issachar. They understand the times and they know what to do. And we even allow kids from the Northeast to come to this thing. They've got a different schedule. I make them come in a day early, and we teach them how to talk right. And if they can get that down, we let them get into policy. But anyway, so it's called Patriot Academy. Pick up a brochure out there and just know God's raising up a remnant of young people that's going to fix everything we messed up. We want to get some of your young people to come and spend that week with us, and then we'll send them back to you, and it'll help you raise up a generation of leaders for your community and for your state right here in North Carolina. I'm gonna close with this one, and then we'll answer some. Actually, you know what? Let's answer some questions, and I'll close with this one after the questions. How's that sound? Pastor, let's just jump right in. I'm sorry I went over, guys. I know y'all are probably ready to go home, but we'll do some questions, and then I want to tell you about Lexington, because I think we're right back at April 19th, 1775, all over again. Okay, good. No questions. I'm going to jump right in. No, I'm just kidding.
All right, so Jonathan has a mic, and we'll move around. Who's got a question? Corbin, come on. I know you have one. You came in here with a question, even before he spoke. Just to give you a heads up, this will be the most difficult one of the night.
All right, we'll start with the hard ones.
All right. Very good.
And if I don't know the answer, then I'm calling David Barton. I'm kidding. I won't know the answer, though. You'll stump me, trust me. I'm no guru, but we're going to have fun anyway.
All right, come on up, Jonathan. Very good.
Oh, look, now that I'm done, I finally fixed the microphone. It's staying. How about that, huh? Why didn't I do that an hour ago? Yes, sir.
Mr. Sean's brilliant. I did come in with a question, and then I came up with another question. main question, though.
Your quota is six. You get six questions. That's it. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
It's good. I think I can fill that quota. First question is...
I don't know the answer to that one. Next question.
The first country, you say that a country requires God as a moral guideline to allow morals in the country.
If you want to be a 225-year successful constitutional republic, yes.
Okay. So how would you explain countries such as Norway, Denmark, Sweden, countries that are primarily either agnostic... Or
I would say they're not anywhere even close to as successful as America, nor are they anywhere near as free. I mean, a buddy of mine that's a member of parliament in Denmark is actually one of the few conservatives there. I mean, they're paying 70% of their income in taxes. That's not free. That's not truly, certainly not the kind of level of freedom that we get to enjoy. So I would say you can have a country that experiences some freedom. But there's just no comparison to the unprecedented level of freedom that we have because of And the reason is biblical foundations of freedom are free market principles. And without those free market principles, you don't get the prosperity that America's created. When you go to Jesus' teachings in the New Testament and what he teaches about no minimum wage, for instance, no capital gains tax, what he teaches about the free market approach and being able to be rewarded for hard work. The idea of American exceptionalism is actually what he was teaching and making sure that you're rewarded for your hard work. So in America, if you invent something and you work hard, you're rewarded for that. And used to, you got to keep a whole lot more of what you made and what you were rewarded with than you do today. But that's why guys like Thomas Edison could have 1,093 patents. That's why a guy like Steve Jobs could do what he did. If Thomas Edison had been born in the Sudan, or if he'd been born in Cuba, it'd be a little darker in here tonight.
Or
right? And if Steve Jobs had been born in one of those countries,
like Norway,
I wouldn't have my iPhone. I'm not so sure if he had been born in Norway or Sweden. Maybe. Okay. I think Canada's a little closer to us in terms of their free. Maybe. But
okay, I just
maybe not.
Because those countries have a higher GDP per capita than the United States, and so they're often...
Maybe right now, because of what we've allowed our country to become over the last 50 years.
Okay, yeah. Well... Right, we didn't have GDP.
But you're not suggesting that Norway or Denmark has been more successful than America, are you?
Well, I thought your argument was more morality, not necessarily successful as far as monetary gain.
Oh, so well, yeah, I would define success as morality, as monetary, as level of freedom and individual liberty, less government intrusion, and all those things would fit into that definition of success. I mean, certainly morality is at the heart of it.
Okay, thank you. That answers the main question.
Cool.
If I could have a secondary question real quick.
Sure.
You mentioned throughout all of this, your arguments and quotes that you listed seem to rule out that most of the founding fathers were atheists. But most of what I've heard as the historians say is that they were mostly deists.
So who did you hear that from?
Mostly from quotes from people like Jefferson, who specifically stated that he disagrees with Christianity as is, but he agrees with the teachings of Christ.
Right, and he's one of the 10 I took off the table. So
he took Jefferson off.
He's one of the 10. So he's one of the 5. That's 5%. And you're actually stating exactly what the problem is, that most historians today who don't go back to original documentation, they quote what one professor said about what one professor said about one professor said, and rarely go back to the original documentation. And so they have taken one or two founding fathers like a Jefferson and even a Franklin. I mean, Franklin, you know, the quote I gave you shows that he clearly believed in God and was not a deist in the way that we think of deists today. So like you just said, historians today say that most of the founding fathers were deists. Well, what does a deist mean to you?
Modern day deist means a God who doesn't interfere with the matters of man.
Yeah, then, so did deist, you see that quote from Franklin?
Back then, deist simply meant believing in a higher power that did care about the matters of man.
So they were involved in the matters of man.
But, however, they were not fundamentalist Christian, which is the main point.
Not those 10 out of 250.
Not those 10.
Right, I concede that. You've got no argument with me. Now, Jefferson will argue with you.
Jefferson would believe he was a Christian.
Right, Jefferson will say, I'm a Christian, but I'm a sect of one. Jefferson was a strange bird. I mean, there were times in his life where he believed in all the fundamental doctrines of Christianity, so he would have fit the definition of Orthodox Christian. And then, you know, 15, 20 years later, he would denounce certain areas of Christianity. And then 15, 20 years later, he would adopt them again. I mean, he bounced all over the place. And so anybody from any side can pick certain quotes of Jefferson and make him look like he believed certain things. Because at different times in his life, he did. I can show him to be an Orthodox Christian at times in his life. And others can show him to be someone that would, quote, hate the church. Because he did hate a lot of preachers in the church because they were saying things about him in the 1800 election that I probably would have hated them too if they were saying that about me. So Jefferson's a strange verse. Why David's book, Jefferson Lies, is so important, because David actually shows the big picture of Jefferson, where most historians today, they only show the negative. They only pull out the negative quotes from Jefferson about all kinds of subjects. And what David does is he steps back and says, wait a minute, let's show the whole picture. Yes, he said these things, and he lists all the things he says that are negative, but then he says, but he also said these things. So like when he says to his nephew, question even the existence of God, well, everybody loves to quote that one line out of the letter. Nobody quotes the whole letter, where Jefferson's actually saying to his nephew, the best way for you to become solid in your faith is to challenge your faith. So you do question with boldness the existence of God, so that you will then discover that there is a God. And so he shows him both sides. So, I mean, I love Jefferson, actually. I think he was an amazing guy, but he doesn't fit into an easy box for anybody today.
Thank you.
You bet.
One last simple question.
Go for it.
Could you give the list of 10 people who you excluded from your...
Oh, no, I couldn't. I can tell you Franklin and Jefferson fit into that category. Thomas Paine fits into that category. Paine is probably the closest to being what we think of as deist today. He's kind of the original intelligent design guy, the original guy that said, there's something up there somewhere that created everything. He didn't believe in no God at all, but he was probably the least... believe the least in involvement of God in our daily lives. So those are three of the more famous names. There were a few others. But we could talk about Charles Cotesworth Pinckney and John Langdon that started the American Bible Society. Those are two of the guys that gave us the Constitution. Rufus King, original manager of the American Bible Society, also gave us the Constitution. William Samuel Johnson gave us the Constitution. This is a guy, president of Columbia, that when he would speak at public school graduations, would preach out of Acts at a public school graduation. I mean, we could go through founder after founder after founder that were, I mean, not just went to church on Sunday morning kind of Christians. I mean, these guys lived it. They talked about it. They spoke it. They wrote it. It was their lives. They weren't Sunday Christians. These were adamant Christians. The problem is that we let historians define the whole lot by one or two. And actually, even the one or two they do, like Jefferson, they misdefine even Jefferson because they don't give the good, the bad, and the ugly. They only give the bad and the ugly. They leave out the good. And the reason it's a challenge for us today is because we're so immediate gratification. We want the little pamphlet. We don't want to take time to go read through, it's kind of the quick start guide. We want the quick start guide to the founding fathers. And so it's very easy to be misled about what they really believed or did. And they weren't perfect. Lord knows they weren't perfect. I mean, I don't deify the founding fathers. But the principles that they put in place, without question, was the most successful formula that any nation has ever experienced. And the reason, they tell us, is because of the biblical impact. I mean, virtually every phrase from the Declaration of Independence that I quoted tonight and that you would recognize from the Declaration had been preached from the pulpit before it ever found its way into the Declaration of Independence. I mean, if you go read the Reverend John Wise, who the founders actually reprinted his sermons because it was such a planting of the seeds of liberty that led to the Declaration and to the Revolution itself. He was always talking about we hold these truths. He was always talking about the things that John Locke, who others also say was a deist, who I don't believe was a deist the way we think of as deist today. I mean, John Locke's two treatises of government, which Richard Henry Lee said that's essentially what they copied the Declaration from as well. I've got a copy of Locke's two treatises of government. It's 404 or 5 pages. It has almost 1,500 references to the Bible. So here's the guy that influenced the founders. They quoted him 2.9% of the time out of all their quotes. They quoted John Locke. So he's pretty heavily, and he was the third most influential man on the founders. So you had Locke, and Blackstone was second, and Montesquieu was top out of those three. Montesquieu was quoted 8.9% of the time, but the Bible was quoted 34% of the time. So the Bible was obviously the main influence. But even Locke, if he's got 1,500 references to the Bible in a 400-page book, that's 3 or 4 biblical references every single page. So the problem I have with the historians today is they deny the biblical influence. You see books like The Godless Constitution, all that kind of stuff. It's just absolutely a distortion of what the founders really believed. I say you tell it all. You tell the good, the bad, and the ugly. You tell what they did that was wrong. You learn from it, and that's how we become a more perfect union.
All right, next question.
Thank you.
Thank you, man. Feel like I'm on a university campus. This is fun.
It helps to sit up close here. You know?
y'all have to arm wrestle over it.
Yeah, that's right. My name's John Dayton.
Hey, John.
And I have an ancestor who was one of the fellows who signed the Constitution from New Jersey, Jonathan Dayton. I can't find anything on the guy. Where would I begin?
I don't know a lot about Jonathan Dayton other than his name. Man, I wish I had an answer for you. I don't. But if you'll grab me afterwards and get me your email address, I'll get you some stuff. Because if David Barton were here, he'd go, oh, well, Jonathan Dayton, he was born here, he went here, he did this, he did that, he did. And the dude is like, I mean, it's unbelievable. I can sit down with him over dinner and say, hey, David, I rattled off a bunch of stuff tonight, but if I go 2 years without looking at it, I'm not going to be able to do it, right? I can sit down with David and go, hey, who's, tell me about this Jonathan Dayton guy. He hadn't looked at it in 6 years, and he just, I mean, it's a gift, I think.
Curtis.
Sorry, but let me know, and I'll get you some good stuff.
So the first question is kind of simple, and then I have a statement that I'd like you to comment on.
The first one, wall builders, and I've heard of them for years. In fact, I've been out to their place out there. I grew up on the west side of Fort Worth. But why the name wall builders?
Great question.
I've never been able to understand.
We used to build houses before. No, I'm kidding. the word wall builders comes from Nehemiah. And when David started Wall Builders, he said, you know, God told me to go read the book of Nehemiah every day for 30 days. And he did. And the phrase out of Nehemiah that says, arise and rebuild the walls that we may no longer be a reproach. Back then, your cities without the outer walls were run over. So your nation would be destroyed if you didn't. That was the strength, you know, militarily of your nation. What David said was, look, our foundation, our principles, our history of who we are, the frame that I was talking about, that's what's been destroyed. And we need to rebuild those walls, those foundations of America. So Wall Builders is about rebuilding the walls in America so that we may no longer be a reproach. We want it to be like Josiah. When King Josiah went and read the scrolls and found out this is what our nation used to be, there was a reformation, a revival in the nation. We think that's happening in America today. The more people look back at the history of who we really are, not what we've been told for the last 40 or 50 years, and we just rediscover the founding principles of America, it's a revival that's happening.
Yeah. Okay, so the second is that as I look at...
Yes, so the Longhorns should be ranked higher, if that was your question. 12th is not... I'm sorry, go ahead.
What God tells us, he never defined a particular government as being more righteous than another. In fact, the only government that he set up was the one... In Judges, where he said, I am your God. You don't need a king, and you don't need a president, and you don't need a Congress, and all that I am your Lord. And it wasn't until that the Israelites rebelled and said, you know, we got to have a king. We got to have a man to look at. So God didn't say that there was an economic system or a governmental system that was more righteous than another. What he did say, though, is that righteousness exalts a nation. And he didn't caveat that with any form of government or economic system or capitalism. But sin is a reproach to any people. And so he told Solomon, he said, if my people, which are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray, then I will heal their nation. And so I guess, you know, it's cool that we have the history that we have. It's enormously... It's wonderful. But I don't think that we can rest on our laurels and say, well, because we have a godly past, therefore we need to have a godly future. Instead, we need to return to the Lord, and any and every nation in the world needs to return to the Lord, needs to turn to the Lord. And if we never do as a nation, if we, the United States of America, never return to the Lord, then we are getting what we deserve, because as a people, like the nation of Israel, we can see in the Old Testament, they got what they deserved. And they got the kings that they deserved, because God used them to oppress them and try to bring them back to him. And so we're kind of in that position right now. So I guess what I'm saying is that we shouldn't return to the Lord because of our history. We should return to the Lord because that is the commandment that God has given to us. And so I just... That's my comment, and I'd like to hear your comment.
Which part would you like me to disagree with
all
first?
Of it. All of it.
Okay, so first I would say that yes, he did give us a form of government that he thought would be better, and it was the children of Israel that demanded the king, like you said. He tried to get them to choose out from among you leaders of tens, fifties, hundreds, thousands. What is that? That's a republic. That's a representative form of government. Tens, fifties, hundreds, thousands, that's what we have. It's local, county, state, and federal government. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, you already have a model right there, and then he gives you the kind of laws that you ought to have. I mean, what is the Bible if it isn't a book of what is right or wrong, which would tell you how to set up government? See, I think the difference in maybe our thinking on this is I don't believe we should in any way separate or compartmentalize our faith. I think that our politics should reflect our faith. The way I run my business should reflect my faith. The way I educate my children should reflect my faith. The way I do everything should reflect my faith. And so government is just an outgrowth of our faith. And I mean, God created government. He government's not bad. I'm not an anti-government person. I think there is definitely a more biblical form of government. I mean, you can't ignore all the things in the Bible that are specific to things like, I mean, like, well, let's take minimum wage. I mean, that's a government issue, right? So why does Jesus say that whether I hire you in the morning or I hire you in the evening, if I want to pay you the same thing for all of that time, that's up to me? I mean, is that not supposed to be a lesson that we take into our economics as well? In other words, I guess what I'm saying is, no, God didn't say, well, I guess in some ways he did, but I can't point to a scripture that said capitalism good, socialism bad. But when I look at the policies that God clearly supports versus those that he does not, he does support free market solutions and not socialism. He never tells us in the Bible to use government to take care of the poor and take away from you. He never tells us that we're going to take care of the poor by forcibly taking money from one to give to another. He tells us to take care of the poor. Jesus always told us to take care. He said, the poor will be with you always. And it's our job in the church and as an individual to take care of the poor, not to use government. That's, you know, there's a lot of people in the church today that think that by having government programs take care of the poor, we're doing what Jesus said to do. I completely disagree. In fact, I can show you statistically that God's way is not only right, it works best. Because if you take any government program that's supposed to be taking care of the poor, 30% of the money actually gets to the poor. 70% is used on the bureaucracy, and 30% gets to the poor. The average for private philanthropy, whether it's a church or a nonprofit organization, is 60% gets to the poor. So God's way is twice as effective as the socialist Marxist solution, which is you need some government bureaucrat doing it instead of us. So anyway, I mean, there's a lot in there that I guess I just disagree with your premise that God never told us the right way to do it. I think he did. I think that he gives us all kinds of support throughout the Bible for the right way to. In fact, you said you had Frank Turek here, his book, to legislate morality. You must legislate morality. Some people say you can't, but you need to.
All right, anyone else? Anyone else? Okay.
No notes allowed. Uh-uh. No. You can't bring notes up here. I get Barton on speed dial.
Actually, I have two questions, and they don't really have to do with one another.
Okay.
The first one is, you said that we need to have our children educated in these things. And as a parent and a teacher, I'd like to know, how do we do that exactly? I mean, every single man in history has been born soft. Yet they were all rendered hard through their life. They were rendered hard through rigorous education, through morals, through religion. Yet we as a society, we are born soft and we remain so mm-hmm. for the rest of our lives. How do we empower the next generation? How do we empower ourselves to stand up, to be strong? How do we do that?
One of the biggest differences between early America and today is that in early America, you had high expectations of the youth and you had a strong work ethic. And what that produced was guys like Andrew Jackson being a POW at 14 years old. Guys like Benjamin Rush being a graduate of Princeton at 14. Guys like John Quincy Adams getting his first diplomatic appointment at 14. John Quincy Adams was out doing musket drills with the Massachusetts Minutemen when he was 8. That's like my 9-year-old going out and doing target practice with Navy SEAL Team 6. I mean, it's the same thing. So anyway, they had high expectations, and the result was amazing. Jefferson
was.
How did they get that?
We as
parents and grandparents are more responsible for helping our children discover their passion and their purpose than anyone else. And I mean, the whole thing we do at Patriot Academy, the whole week is designed to help young people discover their passion, plan their purpose, and then execute the plan. And we haven't done that for generations. What we've done is we've sent our kids off to school and said, go find yourself. And so they spend 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years in college trying to find themselves. And the Bible tells us, where there is no vision, the people perish. Why do you think in the most successful, most free, most prosperous nation in the world, we have high suicide rates and everybody on psychotropic drugs? Because there's no vision. In the Message Bible version of that, it says, if you can't see what God is doing, you stumble all over yourself. Our children are stumbling all over themselves. And so it's our job to help them. I believe when the Bible says that God gave us the desires of our heart, that means he planted inside us certain passions and dreams and purpose. And so it's our job as parents to expose our children to all kinds of things so that they can find that purpose and that passion. For too long in the church, we've said, you want to be good and holy, you go into full-time ministry, and that's it. Instead of saying politics is a ministry, business is a ministry, Education's a ministry. Media's a ministry. Entertainment's a ministry. And now we've got a generation coming up that we got 20-year-olds making feature films. We got young people doing amazing things again, like the founding era. Why? Because a generation of parents said, we're going to challenge them. We're going to have a strong work ethic. We're going to, they can say, well, my friends get to play Xbox 8 hours a day. Well, your friends can do it, but you're not going to do it because you're too good for that, and God's got a purpose for your life, and you're not going to waste it away. Not that Xbox is bad, because I like playing sometimes too, but but 8 hours a day is not going to... Okay, I'm sorry. I'm going off too far. So go ahead. Second question.
I think that's great. I was looking more for A, B, and C. This is what you do for your children, for your classroom, et cetera.
Well, as a nation... Mm-hmm. That the only way the nation is going to get back to high standards and strong work ethic is to stop having a government monopoly on education. You've got to get competition into education. The monopoly on education has allowed us to dumb down the system to the lowest common denominator, to reward bad teachers instead of rewarding good teachers. Competition is not a panacea, but it will absolutely improve education for all kids, and it will raise the standards. And you will see us once again become globally competitive if we can get competition. And we're having, in the last year, an absolute explosion in school choice and competition. And you're going to see great results from that if we can get it in the whole country, for sure.
Okay, second and last question. It doesn't really go together.
Yes, the Texas Rangers are finally going to win the World Series this year. Yes.
No, they're not.
That was not your question? Oh, sorry.
So, my second question would be, you say that we are not to the point of armed revolution being the solution, but however, how do you compare the fact that what the oppression of the early colonists and today's were so much different? And in fact, we are far more oppressed, if you will. I know that doesn't seem like it is, but as far as tax rates go, as far as religious oppression goes, how can you say that we're not at that point?
Because,
I mean, it would be nice if we didn't have to spill our blood in the streets. That
sure.
would be great.
Because they didn't have the tools that they ended up giving us once we were completely free. In other words, they had no way to retaliate against the king.
Our tools are handcuffed at this point.
I disagree.
Okay.
How are our tools handcuffed?
Well, look at our government, our representatives from our states, right? Mm-hmm. Different districts are set up inside the states to elect that representative. Instead of the state being able to send their own representative and say, hey, if you're not doing the bidding of what is good for the state, then we pull you back.
Your state legislature draws those lines, not Congress. Your state chooses where the lines are going to be drawn for Congress.
But it's still representative of the people who are voting, instead of saying that this is what is best for the state. Because then you have people who come from a state, go to Congress because they're representative of a liberal or conservative district, if you will, who make laws simply for that district and what they're wanting, when it doesn't coincide with what the rest of the state wants.
Well, that is more of a problem of the 17th Amendment not having our U.S. senator still chosen by the state legislature. The state is not represented in Congress anymore at the federal government because of that. But I'll say this: show me the most liberal district in your state or my state, either one, and when you can show me 100% of the church in that liberal district voting, then I might agree with you that we're handcuffed. But right now, when only 50% at best of the church is voting, we're not handcuffed. We're lazy.
Don't get me wrong. It's not what I desire.
No, I hear you. But I just want to encourage you and say, look, we have all of the tools we need without handcuffs to save our country. It's a matter of doing it. It's a matter of waking up the American people and doing it. Here's the great news. We don't have to have everybody. You'll never have the whole country want to move the country in the same direction. Even in the Revolutionary War, you had, 25-30% for it, 25-30% against it. Everybody else in the middle, not even paying attention, didn't care, right? It's always going to be that way. It's a small group of the nation that moves the nation one way or the other. The church, for a long time, just checked out. We just stopped influencing it. And we need to go back to what John Hancock said, who said, I urge you by all that is dear, by all that is sacred, by all that is honorable, not only to pray, but to act, to put action to your faith. I'm not at all suggesting, sir, that we should not be praying or that should not be number one. I absolutely agree with 2 Chronicles and say, hey, we should humble ourselves and pray and turn from our wicked ways. That is first. But we have to also act on that faith. We have to let that... What good's the salt if it's lost its flavor? What good's the light if we keep it on? So we got to go out there and do it. And the great news is, with a small percentage actually engaged, we can move the whole nation in the right direction. The nation has not bought into this left-wing socialist policies that we've been adopting. Most people in America do not agree with where we're headed right now. You look at any of the polling data, and most Americans still have... We're very much like that old couple driving down the road in the pickup truck, you know, and the wife's over by the door, and she looks at her husband who's driving, and she says, "Paul," she says, "you remember when we used to snuggle up real close when we was driving?" Her husband's driving. He looks at that seat next to him, looks at the road, looks at his wife. He says, "Ma, I ain't moved." See, the American people are still driving the engine of this country, and a few elite politicians have moved off to the left, but most people in the nation are still right here with us. They believe what we believe, but it's the cycle of freedom. It's the fact that when you get so successful, you get lazy, and you get apathetic. And the question that David Barton asked me on the air about 3 years ago, I should say 3.5 years ago, right after the election of 2008, he said, the question for America right now is whether we're in that cycle at apathy or complacency. If it's apathy, if it's complacency, then that means people just weren't paying attention. They didn't realize we've elected socialism and all that kind of stuff, and they're going to wake up, and they're going to say, no, not on my watch will freedom be lost. If it's apathy, then they knew they were electing socialism, and they don't care, and then it's too late. America is going to be hard to change it. I think 3.5 years after he posed that question, that the answer to the question is without question in my mind, from what I see traveling the country, it was complacency, not apathy. Because after the complacency of 2008, the nation is in an uproar, and there is a red, white, and blue tsunami coming, let me tell you. I mean, and it doesn't take, again, everybody. As much as I'd love to have 50% of Christians voting, if we can get, there are 50 million, swallow these numbers, 50 million Christians in America not voting. We're trying to turn out 5 of those 50 this year. 5 million new Christian voters changes everything. If we can get just 5 of the 50 to vote, then everything changes. And it's not one election, friends. Do not think that November is going to solve everything. This is a generational fight. You got to be in it from now on.
Okay,
but the tools are there.
We're going to have an armed revolution from the nursery if we don't wrap it up. Okay,
we can win. Okay, so, then let me close. Can I close with? Yeah. I want to leave you with Lexington, because friends, I think her questions were right on. I mean, that's exactly what a lot of Americans are feeling, and they think that there's a lot of people saying, "Can we get the nation back to those principles? Can we be successful? Can we?" Hey, you see those guys right there? They didn't know how it was going to turn out. They didn't have all the answers. That was not a well-trained army. That was a militia thrown together by a pastor and his parishioners. Black and white together, young and old, 77 of them lined up on the Lexington Green on April 19th, 1775, the morning after Paul Revere's ride. Here's 77, and up rides Major Pitcairn with 6 companies of British infantry, 800 of the King's finest. They fall into position. They're only 150 feet from our little group of 77. And as they're falling into position, Pitcairn said this. He said, "Disperse ye rebels, disperse ye villains, lay down your arms." Well, our Captain Parker, he walked up and down that line of 77, and he said this. He said, "Don't fire unless fired upon. But if they mean to have war, let it begin here." And then that shot heard around the world was fired. That's where your freedom and my freedom began. The reason I'm here tonight is to challenge you and tell you, if that freedom's going to survive another generation, if my children and your children and grandchildren are going to enjoy the same freedoms we've enjoyed, it's got to begin right here. It begins in our hearts, begins on our knees, thanking God for what we've got, begging for His mercy. But then we've got to go out there in the culture and be salt and light. Generations did it for us, folks. They protected that torch, and they passed it generation after generation. And now it's our turn. We get to stand guard at the Watchtower of Freedom. That's an honor. It's a privilege. My challenge to you and my question is, when history writes a chapter on our generation, will they say of our generation that on our watch the torch of freedom was only dimly lit, or God forbid, extinguished? I don't believe that's going to happen. From what I'm seeing around the nation, people coming out, spending all day studying the Constitution, all the tea parties, all the things happening. I mean, churches, pastors getting involved. I mean, it's like nothing I've ever seen in my lifetime of doing this. I believe that what history is going to say of our generation, they're going to say, on our watch, the torch of freedom burned even brighter than it ever had before. God bless you guys. Thanks for having me. Pastor. All right.